Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 562.JB0409, certificate number 21795, the Halifax Explosion.
Happy Christian holiday season to you, Ken.
Yes, let's put the Christ back in Christian holiday season. In my opinion.
Good old Christmas holiday, Christian holiday season.
Are you full of the spirit of goodwill and merriment?
Jing, 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 jing. I am. We had plans to go to Germany this year to see the Christian holiday that is best done by Germans.
Oh, they've got markets for it.
They do. They literally roast chestnuts on open fires.
They've got Tannenbaums, which they call Christmas trees. Christmas tree urn.
They have all those like weird little markets where you can buy magic tricks made out of matches, and
they've got something where you light a candle and it makes a wooden helicopter spin, and that celebrates the birth of our Lord.
Love that. They have cuckoo clocks, which they have all year long, but they look great at Christmas.
On Christmas, Jesus comes out.
Cuckoo.
He's not cuckoo. He's swaddled.
His famous line, cuckoo. But we didn't go to Germany because of the ongoing coronavirus issue, and also coronavirus has made us into incredibly lazy people. You seem to manage to still get up and travel with your family, and I guess we did drive across the country, but going to Germany just seemed like
it's mostly just cabin fever. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it is an ordeal for sure. I like how it's now the ongoing coronavirus.
Yeah, ongoing coronavirus.
It used to be the novel coronavirus.
No, now it's the
not so novel anymore.
Super boring coronavirus. But I love Christmas overseas, as you know.
Everywhere? Do you love Christmas in Burma?
I do. Christmas in Burma is incredible. I've never spent a Christmas in Burma. I have spent a Christmas in Los Angeles, and that's a terrible place to spend Christmas.
It really, really is.
Have you been there for Christmas?
But mostly because it's a terrible place to spend any day. No, that's mean.
It's really weird to go to California at Christmas time.
I don't like warm weather Christmases, honestly.
Even Hawaii at Christmas is more interesting because it's like, well, there's no pretending. There's not a pine tree in this place. So we just have to laugh it off. And but LA, well, LA has no sense of humor. This is a Christmas story.
Oh, good.
Today's Christmas story involves the deaths of thousands of people, but that's true of the original Christmas story too, and all subsequent Christmases.
That's true. Slaughter of the innocents.
There's a lot of death in Christianity, as there is in everything, because everything dies, Ken.
Yeah. I don't know. I was about to say there's no death on Barney and Friends, which is true.
Not that you see. I
guess dinosaurs have been dead for 65 million years.
I bet if you went back and looked at all the people that worked on Barney and Friends, a not insignificant number of them are probably dead. Almost everybody
that show was, could be called Opioid Epidemic and Friends at this point.
Almost everybody that was alive in Jesus's time is dead.
You say almost.
I think Kenneth Parcell is still alive and still working at NBC.
And Jesus himself, of course.
Right, of course, Jesus.
The reason for the season.
But this is also a story that celebrates Canada.
Yay!
I'm the one of the two of the hosts here who, loves Canada and never besmirches their reputation.
I love Canada so much.
I know. You love them enough that you can criticize them with love.
I just criticize their non-Torontonian Blue Jay fans. I have a very small segment of Canadians.
I guess I've never made that distinction. You feel like Blue Jay fans who are from Toronto are fine and you love them. And
they should support their local squadron. If they want to follow them on the road, that's fine. But if you live 2 hours from Seattle, you should not be driving down to get loaded at a Blue Jays game.
Right.
Get drunk in Vancouver, dude.
This story also celebrates, in addition to celebrating Christmas and Canada, it also celebrates the great city of Boston, which...
I was with you for a while.
We also, you know, we give Boston the business here.
Because Canada is the Christmas of nations. It's so snowy and friendly, full of peace and goodwill.
Right.
But I don't think of Boston as the Christmas of American cities.
Yeah, right. It's not.
The Christmas of American cities is...
St. Paul, Minnesota.
There you go.
Yeah.
The most Canadian of American state capitals.
You're right. Although I think of Boston as like snowy Christmassy kind of place. New York at Christmas is great. There's no question about that. But yeah. New York gets to be number one in a lot of things.
And plus, in a lot of those cities, the snow immediately becomes kind of charcoal slush.
Yeah, right, because they're still powering all of Boston with coal.
Yeah, at Ben Affleck's request. Uh-huh.
What you've been to Germany at Christmas time. What is the best German Christmas city?
I actually have not been to Germany at Christmas time. No, it's my wife's family spent a lot of time in Europe because her dad was embassy. Yeah, she's German born. So they have a lot of... they have a lot of deep ancestral connection to the Christmas markets or Christkindlmarkten. I have no idea what they're called.
But, you know, all the Scandinavian big cities are great at Christmas time.
Yeah. They all put candles in their hair.
They do.
Because it's St. Teresa's Day or something.
They're all worshiping those wreaths.
Please don't send in any corrections of anything I'm saying.
They put a cross on the wall, but it's the wreath that they're really kneeling before.
It's true. They love the wreath. They love the holly. They love the ivy.
They do.
They love the mistletoe. It all has magical powers.
It does. It does because...
The druids knew, and now the Vikings know.
God is a stag who roams the forest.
And he works through his best bushes... which include the holly and the ivy.
Right. We're going to look at a part of Canada here that wasn't always a part of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It is the province of Nova Scotia.
New Scotland.
Right. So that's right, which is an island.
Does it have glens and fens and lochs and firths?
It does. It has all those things.
That's why they named it after Scotland.
It makes its own peaty...
aroma?
It does have a peaty aroma. It only joined Canada in 1867, Nova Scotia.
So there was already a Dominion of Canada, and then there was just British Nova Scotia sitting there?
It was sitting out there. I mean, it was,
doing its own thing?
It had been tainted by all those Acadians that they had to keep chasing off of there.
My guess is it was named for Scotland because it reminded early settlers of Scottish terrain, right?
It does. It does not have a ton of, at least in the northern part of it, it gets pretty treeless and...
My parents lived in a city in Utah named Alpine, and it was exactly why. Like, Swiss settlers to Utah were like, this is the part that looks most like Switzerland.
I was thinking of Labrador when I said it didn't have trees. Of course, Nova Scotia is one of those islands that, it's kind of like a Long Island. Although it seems long, and when you go up it, it seems like you're going north, it really is an east-west island.
Yes.
And when you look at the relative latitude, Halifax is like at the same latitude. I mean, I think Seattle is further north than Halifax.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, Seattle is at 47 degrees north. Halifax is only at 44. We're way north of Halifax.
Yeah.
But we think of it as...
Take that, Halifax.
That's right. Boof. We think of Halifax as being further north because, of course, it's north of anywhere in eastern United States. It's actually level with Maine.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So
I was about to be mad at them for getting all our Social Security numbers hacked, but then I remembered that was Equifax. That was not Halifax's fault at all. Mm-hmm.
That's a joke that your dad would make if your dad had the ability to make an Equifax reference. That's the joke that's going to make you be your dad in 20 years.
I was already a dad. I was already so dad.
Oh, you are a dad. That's right. But yeah, you're going to, your version of being your dad is going to make the 60s look like the 50s.
Halifax is also the home of Hal Foster, the cartoonist who created Prince Valiant. And I was just reading this week about an attempt to put a statue of Hal Foster in the, on the Halifax waterfront where our story will take place, although I don't think it has actually happened. Because cartoonists don't make good statues. What are they, what is he going to be doing? He won't be astride a horse.
No, that's right. Well, it,
maybe they'll put a statue of Prince Valiant instead.
He's like the Jesus in the Thomas Jefferson Bible. He's just not really doing much. Just
he doesn't actually joust or do quests. He just draws someone else who does.
Now, this is the rare omnibus that is, we're going to be discussing something that is, it's a fairly well-known event.
Although not as well-known as you would think, given its magnitude.
Yeah, I think
I asked somebody the other day if they'd ever heard of the Halifax explosion. They had no idea. Maybe Canadians get it in school.
Canadians, well, certainly the people of Nova Scotia know all about it, and the people of Boston also. But you're right, it's not as well known as, say, the World Series, but maybe more well known than the Port Arthur explosion, which actually rivals it. But the Port Halifax explosion is, I think, maybe best known as the largest non-nuclear explosion in human history.
That is to this date. I was wondering if that included the this growth of crazy conventional daisy cutter bombs or whatever they're called.
It nope, does.
Still Halifax?
So the largest non-nuclear bomb in America's arsenal is an 11-ton bomb called the Mother of All Bombs.
That's its name?
The Mother of All Bombs, or MOAB.
For short.
Yeah. And it's, the Mother of All Bombs is about the same size as the Chernobyl explosion.
I wouldn't market it that way if I were them.
It's probably four times bigger than the Oklahoma City Federal Building bomb.
Again, would not brand it that
not
way.
Not a great marketing plan. You may have seen a few years ago that video of the giant chemical plant explosion in China.
Yes.
That was a 20-ton explosion, so twice as big as the Mother of All Bombs.
What about that Beirut one?
So Beirut is a good example. So the biggest bomb that isn't a nuclear bomb, yeah, is the father of all bombs, which is a Russian bomb.
Why do we have the MOAB and they have the FOAB?
So we have the MOAB, their FOAB.
We should make beautiful love. Our bombs should get together and make little baby bombs instead of war.
It's a 45-tonner, so four times bigger than the mother of all bombs.
Yikes.
Which is like this, it's how, it's basically the proportion of an elephant seal. Right, like a boy elephant seal and a girl elephant seal, or a walrus or something.
Or to that guy, or Jaws from Moonraker, he married a little small girl.
Yep. And then the Beirut blast, which I think a lot of people would see as the most recent of these,
just because it was on YouTube, yeah,
was between 300 and 400 tons.
Oh, so that is a biggie.
That's right. It's a big boy. But the Halifax explosion was 3,000 tons.
Oh, so literally an order of magnitude bigger than Beirut, which was an order of magnitude bigger than China or Oklahoma City or these weapons.
That's right. So it's a 3-kiloton explosion. And it actually, on the list of largest explosions, the Port Chicago explosion is number 3 on that list.
Which we have done an omnibus, right?
Yeah, we did the Port Chicago explosion. It was the one in San Francisco Bay.
That was the Navy thing?
Yeah, and that was about 2 kilotons. So this is even larger than that. Now, by comparison to a nuclear explosion, the Trinity test, the first nuclear explosion in the desert, was 25 kilotons. So there are much smaller nuclear bombs. But that gives you a sense, like
little. It's like the land speed record changing from human to train.
Yeah, basically. Right. Okay. But it still is the largest non-nuclear explosion, and it was an explosion that devastated the city of Halifax, killing 2,000 people.
Wow. See, this is like, again, kind of a 9/11 scale disaster that I think the average American, at least, has never heard of.
Yeah, and not only did it kill 2,000 people, but it it injured another 10,000 people. It destroyed 1,600 houses leveled, as well as 12,000 houses and buildings damaged, some significantly damaged.
It's like a hurricane level humanitarian crisis.
It was super gnarly. And to make matters worse, it happened on December 6th. So it was also super duper cold. And, you know, and Halifax.
Even though Halifax is south of Seattle?
Even though it's south of Seattle, it is on the North Atlantic. Yeah. And so super cold and snowy. The story of the explosion, it was a shipping disaster. This is a boat party. And it happened in the middle of World War I. So Halifax is, there's a natural harbor in Halifax called Bedford Basin. And it's one of the largest and best, sort of most protected harbors in the world. And it was, you know, it had played a large role in the transatlantic shipping.
It's probably why Halifax exists, right?
It is. And it was, and in an era when shipping from the United States tried to, you know, ships tried to make the transit across the Atlantic at its shortest point, a lot of ships from New York would go up to Halifax, fuel up, make the crossing. And ships coming the other way from Europe to the United States would land in Halifax first, fuel up, get your act together, get some fresh pajamas, and then head south. So Halifax did a booming business as a transit point.
Did we say or imply that all of Nova Scotia is an island? Because it's not.
No, it's not.
All right, only Cape Breton Island is an island. The rest is a peninsula barely connected to New Brunswick.
And, you know, Nova Scotia was briefly, I mean, there was a chance of it being part of the United States. Nova Scotia.
Last year. They voted down. The referendum was voted down.
Nova Scotia and Boston have a long history together as, you know, cities that that were mutually supportive during the American Revolution. You know, there was the Nova Scotians did not necessarily ally themselves with the British cause and super enthusiastically.
Yeah. Thanks, you know, Nova Scotia.
There's a long-standing friendship between Nova Scotia and America. And Nova Scotia is kind of like to your Toronto question. Nova Scotians, and particularly people from Halifax, who are known as,
yeah, I love this word,
Haligonians.
Yeah, because Oregonians are from Orifax.
Right.
So why wouldn't Haligonians be from Halifax?
So Haligonians, I think, traditionally root for Boston sports teams.
Really?
Yeah,
but they don't like drive down to ruin homestands because they're not cheering for the Blue Jays.
Maybe they do. But like, I think the Patriots, anytime a Boston sports team wins a trophy or a championship, at some point they take the trophy to Halifax and it sits in state for a couple of days. So all the Haligonians can come and like, see the Stanley Cup or the, you know,
I love that Boston has an overseas territory.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
Good job. You don't even need a passport.
Yeah. The two towns are like super, super bro towns. And when the Patriots changed their scoreboard several years ago, they took the old scoreboard up to, and gave it to some high school in Halifax. Like it's a real,
they should run the T up to Halifax. I mean, I know it would be a long, long train trip.
Yeah, that would
underwater.
Well, and it would be through Maine.
No, you go.
Oh, across you go the long way.
You go across the North Atlantic. Yeah.
Well, so during World War One, I mean, the Canadian Navy only really separated from the Royal Navy, really just sort of a few years prior. And the Royal Navy,
it was a long and gradual
independence process. And there was a lot of, I think the conservative position in Canada was that we didn't need, they didn't need their own Navy. They could rely on the Royal Navy. And I think it was really British Columbia that was saying, well, the Royal Navy isn't really over here very much.
In the North Pacific.
We have a lot of islands and smugglers and other stuff. We would kind of, we need our own Navy. But it was the liberal position, I guess, politically, that Canada should have its own Navy. And the Royal Navy aided the formation of the Canadian Navy by giving the Canadians their most used up, absolutely thrashed and just rotting old ships.
We're not going to give you anything you could shoot at us with.
And then they charged them for it. And that's actually true. Like, they gave the Canadian Navy a few ships, and then they said, but you can't go to sea. Like, the Canadian Navy was like, great, we're going to go down to Haiti. We're going to do a tour of the Caribbean. And the Royal Navy was like, no.
That's kind of our thing.
No. So they had to work that
out. Well, it worked. To this day, the Canadian Navy and the British Navy have never come to, there's never been a single sea battle between the two.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. Maybe a couple friendly fire incidences around around the Falkland Islands. But we're talking about 1917. And at this point, there is, there's tremendous cross-Atlantic traffic around World War I. And this is the heyday of the U-boat. And so it's the beginning of that, it's the dawning of that era of giant convoys of slow-moving ships all traveling together under the protection of Royal Navy destroyers, kind of fueling the war effort from the United States. The United States now has entered the war by 1917.
Okay.
But still, there's a lot of, you know, there's so much manufacturing happening in the U.S., in particular explosives and oil, and we're supplying the armies of France and the United Kingdom.
And so some of that stuff goes via Nova Scotia instead of across directly? Or?
All of it, because again, it's the shortest distance, and in order to avoid exposure to U-boats, there was a kind of like, let's all consolidate inside Halifax Harbor. Let's get our convoy together. And the Halifax Harbor was protected by anti-U-boat nets strung across the mouth of the harbor.
I didn't know U-boats were stopped by nets.
They were. So you could string a net across any kind of shallow opening, and it keeps the U-boats out there, like,
do they get tangled in it like flypaper?
Yeah.
Or are they just like, we can't get through that badminton net, sir?
No, they get tangled in it. I think some of them have mines attached to them. So it keeps them from doing that thing that a U-boat would do, which is actually come in the harbor and sink a bunch of ships like right there.
Not if Tyrion Lannister is on duty in Halifax or whatever.
It's been zero episodes since we made a Game of Thrones reference.
Reset the counter.
On this particular day in December, Halifax Harbor and Bedford Basin were crammed with ships from all over. And among those ships, there was a Norwegian freighter that was being used as sort of a Red Cross humanitarian ship. It had Belgian Relief painted on the side of the ship.
It had the words Belgian Relief,
Belgian
or it
Relief.
Had the concept of Belgian Relief painted on it?
You know, Belgian
a big,
Relief.
It's a big Thomas Hart Benton mural.
It's an antacid, actually. it was like basically saying hospital ship, yeah. Except it was making this, it was transiting between the United States, where it would collect a bunch of supplies for the Belgians who had Germans all around them, but
the beleaguered Belgians.
Yeah, they were beleaguered. It was very muddy.
You know what you don't want in a war seasons. Is to be beleaguered. It's got to be the worst thing.
Well, you know, you're a Belgian, you're sitting there, the Germans come by, rawr! You're like, and then they're passed for the most part, unless you live in right on the border.
But your heart's still going pitter pat.
Yeah. And then they're over there and they're presumably eating all the sheep and pigs and scavenging for, you know, they've taken all your silverware.
And somebody says, Monsieur, how do you feel?
Monsieur.
And you say, I am beleaguered.
Yeah.
I am so beleaguered.
Sacre bleu. Or if you're in the north of Belgium, you go, ach.
you got a Dutch accent
you say,
here?
Let op drempels. So this ship is now, and so the ship is called the SS Emo.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Related to BMO.
That's a good name for a hospital ship.
Yeah, the emo.
Because like battleships are not emo at all, in my opinion.
No, and this is IEMO.
Oh, IMO? Like IMO. That imitation sour cream? Did you ever eat that stuff?
No.
I feel like my parents would always buy emo brand fake sour cream.
I've always just eaten the real sour cream.
Do they still sell it? Now I'm only interested in imitation sour cream.
It might even be a Norwegian product. Do they sell it?
I can't find it.
Imitation sour cream sounds so Norwegian to me.
The rise of emo Phillips and then emo music probably killed emo as a sour cream
brand.
Please, if you know anything about the corporate history of emo fake sour cream, let us know. But back to your hospital ship.
So the emo is not actually a hospital ship. It's just taking supplies to Belgium. It's flying under the Norwegian flag. But it is here in Halifax as a stopover. It's made the crossing. It's stopping over. And then the following morning, it's meant to head down to New York to load up. And I'm not sure exactly, you know, Norway being neutral, the supplies from America, which would at that point be a belligerent, are still somehow able to make it to Belgium.
Does that keep the U-boats off your back?
Somehow, if it says Belgian Relief on the side. But the Emo is kind of an old tramp steamer. Almost all of the ships in our story were built in the late 19th century. The Emo was built in 1889. And it's kind of an old-fashioned steamship. It had one propeller, like a right-turning propeller. The ship was long and thin. It was over 400 feet long, but only 45 feet wide. Mm. And because it was sailing empty, you know, it just had ballast to keep it from tipping over, but it was riding really high in the water, so high in the water that the propeller was kind of half exposed and the rudder was half out of the water.
This was supposed to be a known thing with these ships that when they're empty, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. They just kind of turn into like a skateboard on an ice rink. Not really. And you know, they didn't fill it with ballast because, of course, there's nothing in Belgium at the time. What are you going to fill it with? You know, moss?
French fries?
Yeah, the Germans ate all the French fries. So the boat's riding real high. And it came into Halifax Harbor and was actually scheduled to leave on December 5th, but it couldn't get out in time. It didn't, you know, it didn't get fueled up fast enough.
And that's the crucial coincidence?
And they closed the submarine fence. So it was kind of trapped until the next day.
I'm sure history would have been very different if that ship had gotten
out. This
is the equivalent of Mark Wahlberg missing his flight.
That's exactly it. On the other side of the submarine fence, a ship coming from New York and destined for France, laden with explosives, gets to the harbor too late.
They close it up at night?
They close it up at night.
It's like a castle?
Yeah. Gets there too late to get through the fence. And in the past, the general rule for Halifax Harbor was if you have a ship of explosives, you don't come in to the harbor. You stay off, and if you're unloading explosives or dangerous cargo, you know, you do it by smaller ship. You know, you bring it in a little bit at a time.
Sensible. No one can say Canada is not sensible.
But because it's a wartime situation and because they're forming up as convoys, they'd kind of briefly suspended that rule. And this ship, the SS Mont Blanc, was scheduled to arrive and was going to be led into the harbor the following morning, the morning of the 6th. So the morning of the 6th dawns, and the Emo is raring to go, and the Mont Blanc is coming in. The Emo's going out, the Mont Blanc's coming in. Both ships are being piloted by local Halifax pilots. So the captain of the Emo.
You hand it over to somebody who knows the local geography.
Yeah, and that's true. And that's true anywhere that you've got a busy shipping area. The captain of the Emo is a Norwegian by the name of Håkon Frohm, but his pilot is a local guy named William Hayes.
I'm looking at the channel. It's maybe I don't know. It's like 1,500 feet wide at its narrowest.
Yeah.
Should be able to get two boats through.
You should. And we will see what happened. The Mont Blanc, the captain of the Mont Blanc is named Aim Le Medic, but the pilot is Francis Mackey, a local, you know, local guy. Two local guys.
Dressed as the Gorton's fishermen.
That's right. They're
yellow slicker.
They meet coming through the rye. Well, so the SS Emo is in a hurry. She was supposed to leave the night before, and the pilot is like, it's crack of dawn. We've pulled the fence back, and it's crack of dawn, but it's Nova Scotia in December. So dawn is like 7:30 in the morning.
Still, that's early for an emo.
Pretty early for an emo, speaking from firsthand experience. and the emo kind of floors it and is exceeding the local speed limit.
Ooh.
On its way out of the harbor, and encounters a ship kind of coming the other direction.
Not the Mont Blanc.
Not the Mont Blanc, but it first encounters a tramp steamer from the United States called the SS Clara. And the Clara is kind of coming up the wrong side of the channel.
Come on. Classic American overseas, driving on the wrong side of the road.
Right. Ships, when they meet head on, are supposed to pass port side to port side. So just like you're driving on the right side of the road in the United States or the other nations of the world, where you drive on the right side of the road, which is to say
nearly all of them,
not England or Japan. You pass with your left side next to one another. But as the Emo is kind of hauling through the channel, it comes upon the Clara and realizes that that the Clara is,
there's not room.
Not room. So they go to the left, meaning they're going to pass them starboard
with their
to starboard.
Starboard side to.
Right. And they go zipping by the Clara, at which point they encounter a tugboat, the Stella Maris, and the Stella Maris is pulling two barges, and the Stella Maris is correctly positioned in the channel, but now the Emo is
on the wrong side.
On the wrong side. And so the Emo, under the command of William Hayes, decides, well, we're going to go wide on the Stella Maris also.
Starboard to starboard.
Starboard to starboard.
They're going to stay on the side they're on. Okay.
The problem is that the Emo is riding so high and has this right, you know, this the rudder and the screw are half out of the water. It's very hard to maneuver the ship. It does not turn on a dime, and because they're going fast, it's just that much harder to control the ship. And Hayes seems to feel like he can just hot dog out of here. There's boats everywhere in the harbor. He's just going to kind of point it.
So there is some human error involved.
Point it out. Yeah. He's playing pretty.
He's a daredevil.
Pretty fast with this, right? So here comes the Mont Blanc, and you know, Francis Mackey has spent the night on the ship. He went out the evening prior as the pilot. And then they closed the fence. So he'd spent the evening, I guess, probably drinking 265-year-old cognac with Captain Medic. But they're coming in, and over a kilometer away, he sees the Emo on the wrong side of the channel. And he hits his horn, and in the, you know, in the lexicon of boats, one horn is, you know,
get over,
get back in your lane.
Well, that's what I use it for when I'm driving. That's same code.
Yeah. And your all electric car has that exact horn, right?
That's right.
But in reply, the Emo replies with two horns, which is to say, we're not going to change course. We're coming at you. And it's an expression of like, we can't change course, really. Yeah. We're moving too fast. The Stella Maris pulling its two barges kind of you know, pulls like a maneuver, but, you know, and manages to avoid a collision. But now the emo is pushed way out and is super duper in the wrong lane. The Mont Blanc hits the horn again. The emo replies, bomp, bomp. And so Francis Mackey cuts the engines.
Right. That's what you should.
And at this point, the emo cuts its engines, but they are on a collision course.
Oh.
And they're both now moving kind of without power, just sort of like, you know, like, here we go. Well, the emo has no way of knowing that the Mont Blanc has on board 200 tons of TNT, 10 tons of gun cotton, which is an explosive form of explosive.
Is this for military use?
Is this all heading
to Europe for the war?
All for shells and cannons. And then 2,300 tons of an explosive called Explosive D. Explosive D has about 100 names. It's called lyddite. It's called picric acid, I guess, is its sort of chemical composition.
The difference is you can't drop a Fire New Mixtape as the name picric acid.
Picric acid.
But you could as Explosive D.
Explosive D, it's also called dunite. And it is a highly volatile explosive.
Is it still used? I guess I've never heard of Explosive D.
All this stuff is used in shells, in bombs. I mean, a lot of it is, this is something I kind of didn't know until doing this research. A lot of those explosive cannon shells, the explosive mixture is actually poured in as a liquid and then solidifies. And like TNT goes into those shells as a liquid. One of the things that
like Jell-O.
Yeah. One of the things that defines TNT is that it's a very stable explosive.
Not in Roadrunner cartoons, it's not.
Not in Roadrunner cartoons. But in general, TNT was originally discovered, originally developed as a yellow dye, like a dye to use in... And for dozens of years,
people who wore yellow kept blowing up and no one could figure out why.
No, they had no idea it was an explosive.
Because it's so stable.
Ooh. It requires so much sort of heat and... And it's one of the reasons that TNT is so effective as a munition, because something like picric acid, which is less stable,
just breathe on it.
Well, and it has a tendency, if you shoot a shell at something, the shell explodes the first time it encounters any, you know, it explodes on the outside of the tank, it explodes on the outside of the bunker. Mm-hmm. TNT is stable enough that the shell will actually penetrate the structure before exploding.
So if you see a yellow shirt at the thrift store, maybe be careful.
Yeah, it was used as a yellow dye for a long time before they discovered that it was actually an explosive. But then, to add to the roadrunneriness of the SS Mont Blanc, on the deck of the ship were barrels and barrels and barrels of benzole. Or benzole, which is a kind of...
Unless it's Mexican food, unless it's like a Mexican stew.
Benzole. And benzole is a combination of benzene and toluene. It's a kind of a jet fuel it's a refined sort of gasoline-y, high-octane fuel.
Great. Just what you want.
And it's up there on the deck. Well, so now here we are in Halifax Bay. It's a maritime... Not only a maritime province, but a maritime town. And the sound of these ships honking at each other is something that a lot of the people in Halifax recognize as like, oh, that one ship is like, get out of my way. And the other ship is like, no.
So it'd be like hearing a foghorn. They immediately understand the
They know what's the happening. They know it's a conversation. And so people in Halifax turn their attention to the bay. Like, what's going on down there?
Let's all head down to
the... Yeah, people get up and look out the window. People come down to the shore. Like, oh, this is an interesting, you know, turn of events on a December morning.
There's no TV.
So the ships are now headed to toward one another. And somewhere at the last minute, Francis Mackey,
That's the incoming ship, the Mont Blanc.
That's the Mont Blanc. Says he's going to swing across the bow of the Emo in order to try and avoid a head-on collision, get across and, you know, and pass on the other side, like slip past. Mm-hmm. He succeeds in the maneuver, and the two ships get next to each other, side by side, parallel, very close to one another, at which point the Emo sounds her horn three times, meaning I'm going in reverse. I'm going to reverse engine.
Why would the Emo do that? Just to try to stay as stable as possible, as stationary as possible while they're getting past at close quarters?
Yeah, or, you know, or if it looks like they're inches apart, you know, I'm going to put it in reverse and kind of get away. Unfortunately, the way that the screw on the Emo turns, it's a right-hand screw, and reversing course causes the boat to yaw. And at the kind of last minute,
it's twisting. It's one end of it is twisting. Either the bow or the stern is twisting toward the Mont Blanc.
That's right. It's got what's called transverse thrust, and it twists itself into the Mont Blanc. Now at this point, they're hardly moving.
All they had to do was nothing, and it would have been fine.
All they had to do was stop speeding through Halifax Harbor and stop, like, going, you know, passing everybody in the oncoming
lane.
You're
such a dad. If you hadn't been horsing around in the first place.
That's right. All they had to do was get fueled up the night before and get the heck out of Dodge. But they were horsing around. They bump into each other at one knot. You know, it's just a bonk. But it's enough of a bonk that the barrels of benzol, a few of them tip over on the deck. They tip over and they smash on the deck, and benzol starts washing over the side of the ship down into the holds. The ship is now covered with the deck of the Mont Blanc is now covered with benzol dripping down the side.
This is like a Rube Goldberg.
It's crazy.
Disaster.
It pours down now benzol is like soaking the side of the ship all the way down to the water. And then in the reversing, so now they've bumped, now the Emo starts to reverse, and the two hulls dragging against each other spark, and the benzol catches on fire. And the ship, you know, the side of the ship erupts in benzol flames. Well, everybody on shore in Halifax and all of its environs. Now, Halifax is a city that is made up of several smaller cities, Richmond, Dartmouth. There's it's like a municipality.
You're very conversant.
Yeah, that goes
in
well.
In the suburbs, you know, of Halifax.
I love Halifax. It's one of the great cities. I keep thinking Halifax is about the size of Anchorage. I keep feeling like maybe Halifax is where I'm destined to live. But I've looked into real estate prices there, and it's not cheap to live in Halifax. You want it to be. You want to be like, oh, I'm living in Halifax.
That's because Sloan makes it sound so good when they sing about it.
That's right. That's the main Sloan fans thing.
It's Sloanaganda.
Yeah, 5 million Sloan fans can't be wrong. Or in this case, 50,000 Sloan fans can't be wrong. Anyway, so the ship catches on fire. Well, no one else in Halifax knows that the Mont Blanc, which is just arriving, is like the most, it's just absolutely laden with the most explosive things there are. In 1917 terms, there's none more explosive than this ship. And so everybody's like, whoa, check it out. The ship's on fire. Hey, Mom, come on. Check it out. In the harbor right next to it, the Stella Maris,
who's the tugboat.
The tugboat, watching this all go down, realizes that they're, you know, the closest boat to respond, and they turn their fire hose on and start trying to fire hose the ship, you know, put the fire out, but it's not effective. Moored right there is the HMS Niobe, which is a capital ship in the newly formed Canadian Navy. The Canadian Navy kind of went back. The Royal Navy took over Halifax during World War I, but this was a Canadian Navy ship that had had performed valiantly for Canada for a very short period after they bought it from the Royal Navy. And it only took them a few tours to realize that the ship was rotting.
It's a lemon.
It was rotting in its... And so they berthed it there, and it never sailed again, but it was still a Canadian naval vessel. It was being used not just a training vessel, but kind of as a depot there in the harbor. The sailors on the Niobe realized that they needed to, you know, try to tow the Mont Blanc and get her out of the channel.
Do they realize that the Mont Blanc is, or they just know it's on fire?
They know it's on fire. Now, Captain Aime Le Medic they have abandoned ship because he realizes this fire is out of control and this boat is a bomb. And so the crew abandoned ship into their lifeboat.
Even the captain?
Even the captain. And they start pedaling to get out of there. And he is shouting to everyone who can hear, is les bombes!
Les explosives!
Les explosives!
Très formidable!
Sacré bleu! You know, allons-y!
Isn't the captain supposed to go down with his exploding ship?
Not always. Yeah. So he's trying to alert everybody, but of course, he's in the middle of a clanging, busy harbor. He can't get anyone's attention. And they, wisely, being the only people in the harbor that know what's happening, get the heck out of Dodge. The Niobe and the Stella Maris, the two crews, you know, are working to get a line to the ship. They're trying to, you know, they're out kind of in their little, rowboats, working hard to get her off of, and she's at this point has sort of drifted. So she's drifting now. There's no crew.
Yeah, the engines were off anyway.
She's drifted over into the Richmond side of the harbor. And at 9:04 a.m., the fire reaches the payload, or the TNT heats up, or the picric acid finally, you know, the knee bone connects to the hip bone.
Explosive D lives up to its name.
And the ship goes up. And it explodes with such force that briefly the basin, the floor of the Narrows is exposed.
Wow.
The
water is pushed aside all the way to the floor.
All the way to the channel. Yeah, bare ground of the channel is revealed.
Fish flapping around.
The ship, the Mont Blanc is vaporized.
Wow.
You know, the kind of carcass of the ship goes 1,000 feet in the air. There's a 60-foot tsunami.
And it's a 60-foot tsunami, and shore is just like a few hundred feet away,
sure,
right?
It's just sitting right there. It's not even a few hundred feet away. The boat is just right there.
Oh, man.
But it sends the tsunami, you know, across to Dartmouth. It basically destroys central Halifax. In the explosion, because so many people are watching, just like looky-looing, 250 people who didn't die lost at least one eye.
Just from the brightness of the...
Or from shrapnel.
Oh, stuff flew at them.
37 people were permanently blinded. Jeez. The boat, the Mont Blanc, vaporized and became and liquefied. So it sent metal pellets. There are neighborhoods in Halifax where you can dig in the ground and there's still like shards of the Mont Blanc, little tiny metal pellets.
The boat just flew everywhere in specks.
It flew everywhere in specks. Oh. There was a cannon on the Mont Blanc because all these boats had, by this point in time, had long histories. Like the Mont Blanc was built in 1899. The Emo was 1889. The SS Clara, the boat that was kind of headed in the wrong direction in the first place, was 1882. They all had long lives, and the cannon from the Mont Blanc, which was a 1,200-pound cannon, flew 2 miles, and is now a public park. Like they,
where it landed?
Yeah. They put the cannon, you know, they put the cannon on a pedestal and they're like, here's Cannon Park. Crazily, the anchor of the Mont Blanc flew 2.5 miles in the opposite direction. It weighed over 1,000 pounds. So, and the anchor is in a park called Anchor Park. And it's on Anchor Road. This was the singular event in Halifax history. Absolutely in the, devastating.
In that nothing else has ever happened there. It's the single event.
Yeah, I mean it wiped out the town.
I mean, that's the biggest event in the Western Hemisphere. Like that's a.
I mean, globally, it's the largest explosion that ever that ever happened.
I mean, nothing can beat it
up until that point.
But like as a 9/11 scale, you know, humanitarian disaster and just loss of life and spectacle, like it's as good as anything that, I mean, good. It's as terrible as anything that happened in the early 20th century.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of these things no one had ever seen before. Like the smoke cloud was 20,000 feet high. Well, no one, outside of a volcano, no one would have ever seen a mushroom cloud, for instance, that big. The city hall clock, very much like Back to the Future, is forever stopped at 9:04 a.m.
Oh, to this day.
To this day.
That's nice. That's a little memorial. I'm sure they could fix it.
And all over Halifax, there are little, you know, signs and memorials. Everybody's got a story. A lot of people lost a lot of family members. St. Paul's Church has a iron spike that just got embedded in a doorway that's still there. But even weird, more weird, upstairs there's a stained glass window that supposedly you can see the shadow of the profile of a church deacon who was
like standing there,
and got not, it's not like Hiroshima. He didn't get vaporized, but he got died and his shadow is still on the window.
I mean, that's the same at Hiroshima. I think just the people that were standing on the street blocked some of the, whatever the bleaching effect of the flash.
Of the flash. Right. Yeah. Of course, immediately there was, and strangely, this is the amazing thing. No one from the crew of the Mont Blanc died, except for one soldier who was pierced by some flying shrapnel.
They got far enough away.
They got far enough away, and they were fine.
I wonder if being at sea level was better. Like, I wonder if stuff went up.
A lot of people died on both the Stella Maris and the Niobe.
What about the Clara that caused the whole thing?
The emo. Oh, the Clara just kept on.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Those guys just got out of there.
Yeah, they did, and nobody yelled at them. The emo actually was lifted out and then pushed by the tidal wave into, like, beached, destroyed. The crew died. You know, all the haze and foam.
All hands just died in the collision.
They died in the explosion. Not in the collision. The collision.
Well, I guess, like, I mean the collision with the shore.
No, I think they were. I think the explosion was so great that it killed them at their posts. Huh. Maybe I think there was one crewman that survived because he was bending down to tie his shoelaces or whatever. But they actually refloated the emo, and it continued to be a. It was renamed and went on and had not a long life, but a life.
Was emo renamed like shoegaze or something?
Yeah, it was named. I think it was actually named something like the Colonel, or it had. It ended up having a weird name, and it had some. It got into some scrape, and I think it ended up sinking in the Falkland Islands, because that's where all great Halifax ships go to die
in the South Atlantic.
But public sentiment was at the time very anti-French, and you can imagine in Canada. It being somewhat complicated, your feelings about the French at any given time.
Sure.
But there was...
So everyone blamed the Mont Blanc.
Yeah, they blamed the Mont Blanc.
Not without reason, I guess.
A judge was appointed, Justice Drysdale, who took everything into consideration and decided that if you are the captain of a ship full of picric acid... It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. It's still your responsibility to not catch your ship on fire.
Fair enough.
So even if everybody else in Halifax is riding around on jet skis shooting Roman candles,
you just got to sit tight till it's safe.
You got to figure it out. Yeah. Right. And so Mackey as the pilot and Lemedec were both put on trial.
Man, I wonder what it's like to be those guys and know that 2,000 people are dead because of your questionable piloting.
Well, they both said, oh, and also I feel like the guy that was running the gate, the net,
yeah,
was also held partly responsible, that he shouldn't have let the ship through the net.
Like, or, the night before?
Yeah, or that morning.
Yeah.
But Mackey in particular made a case that, like, wait a minute, you can't prosecute me for this. Like, I was just driving the boat like a normal guy, and these guys who are now dead, the emo,
they bumped into me.
And so in the end, no one was successfully prosecuted. Ultimately, the Supreme Court of Canada declared both parties equally responsible, because, of course, both shipping companies were suing each other for damages.
And maybe the most culpable people had not survived.
Yeah, everybody. I mean, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
You're kind of piecing it together. But the city of Boston enters into it because, as I said, the city of Boston and the city of Halifax.
So far, this has been pretty light on Yuletide cheer.
Yeah, John. Right. Well, like so many Christmas stories.
Right.
Right.
It's got to start with a scary ghost or a savings and loan guy trying to jump off a bridge.
You know, the little matchstick girl dies.
That's not a Christmas story, but okay.
It isn't? How is the little matchstick girl not a Christmas story? Oh, it's the little drummer boy. I always get those two confused. They're both little, and one, they're, you know, two of many possible genders.
Honestly, if you've got a baby in a stable, you'd probably rather have a shivering street urchin than a kid playing the drum.
Yeah, right. Thank you. The city of Boston hears about this via telegraph and immediately rallies and puts together an entire train of relief supplies, hospital stuff.
This must have been a big cause, like a Katrina-style humanitarian effort.
They fill the train with nurses and doctors. Boston, like rallies. They put this crazy train together, and they send it immediately that night. You know, by 10 p.m. that night, they send the train off to Halifax. The train gets caught in a blizzard, so it doesn't get there the following day. But the next day, the train arrives, and at this point, of course, it's the temperatures are below freezing. Halifax is completely destroyed. All the hospitals have been overflowing. Everybody is absolutely at their last, using their last reserves of strength. And then here comes this train from Boston, the ho ho ho, Mary,
the Polar Express.
Polar Express full of yummy clam chowder and
Boston sent all the clam chowder and baked beans it had available
and nurses and doctors, and it arrives, and Halifax, which felt like they were, you know, at the end of the earth, and how was help even going to arrive? You know, the nation of Canada reeling, not even sure probably most of them where Halifax is, and here comes this train from Boston. And so this tremendous goodwill that already existed between Halifax and Boston is just cemented. And the following year, at Christmas time, the city of Halifax sends a giant Christmas tree via, you know, like this beautiful sort of big spruce. They send it down to Boston as a thank you gift.
How do you think you do that? You load it on the back of a truck?
Yeah, you put it on a train. Send it. It's the train going the other direction. In 1918, I don't know how many.
I'm just wondering how they do it today. Like, how do they? You know, when they're always like, "This is from the Great North Woods, and here it is at the White House or Rockefeller Center." Like, do they? Can you put a? I guess you can tie it up like a Christmas tree and just put it on the top of your car.
Well, we know how they do it to this day because in 1971, the Lunenburg, the Halifax-based Lunenburg Christmas Tree Company. Because apparently one of the industries in Halifax is Christmas trees.
It's tree farming.
And sending Christmas trees to the United States.
Haligonians and Oregonians are not so different after all.
It's all Lunenburg, Christmas tree farms. That's right. It's Christmas tree farms all the way down. Lunenburg says, hey, why don't we resurrect this tradition, and we'll send Boston a Christmas tree from Halifax or from Nova Scotia, you know, as a thank you and to cement the goodwill between our great cities.
When is this, 71?
1971.
Okay, so it's been over 50 years since the disaster, but.
And they send the train down. So there's, or they send the tree down. There's a train that runs between Boston and Halifax. That's a a train over 100 years old that was like a weekend train, right? If you were a Boston Brahmin business person and you didn't want to vacation in Kennebunkport.
Was it the daddy train?
It was called the Blue Nose, which is the daddy train of the East. And so this Blue Nose route, although I don't think it anymore carries passengers, it's still, the Blue Nose still makes this transit as a freight train between the two cities, because Halifax is this incredible shipping, an incredible port, a diverse port. And so a lot of the stuff that's coming into Boston goes into Halifax and then comes via the Blue Nose. Weirdly, this is a completely crazy aside, but after the dissolution of Pan Am Airways in the early 90s, mm-hmm. Pan Am, the great airline of the 20th century, went bankrupt. The Pan Am name got sold at some auction as they were tearing apart this incredible, at the time that Pan Am went out of business, it was like the second most recognized trademark in the world after Coca-Cola.
And they just sold the name?
They sold the name to some regional airline that flew from Provincetown to Grand Bahama. Uh-huh. That airline went bankrupt. They sold the name to an even more regional airline that went from Amarillo to Fort Worth. That thing went bankrupt. They sold the name a couple of more times, and ultimately the name and logo of Pan Am Airways was purchased by the Guilford Transportation Industries Corporation, which ran the Blue Nose freight train from Halifax to Boston.
Wait, do they use it? Is the Pan Am airline logo on this freight train?
And they changed the name. Guilford was like, well, what should we do? Keep Guilford Transportation or change our name to Pan Am? They changed their name to Pan Am Railways using the Pan Am logo from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Wow.
On their regional freight train from Halifax to Boston.
Squad goals. Like, this just makes me want to buy some defunct company's IP when it goes out of business.
And yeah.
Just own the AT&T sphere or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, right. Just Ken Jennings's IBM coffee shop. And they only just in 2020 sold Pan Am Railways to the giant railway conglomerate CSX.
So they're not going to use the logo anymore, probably.
Well, maybe CSX is going to change their name to Pan Am.
If they're nostalgic.
That would be so brilliant. Anyway, starting in 1971, this then became a tradition between the two cities. And ever since then, every year in the fall, some resident of Nova Scotia either comes forward and volunteers, because the thing is, you can't just pick a tree out of a forest, right? A Christmas tree has to be a tree that kind of stands apart because you want it to be symmetrical. You want the tree to be big and tall and
right.
Round.
And this is one of these enormous Christmas trees for some public space on Boston Commons or whatever.
So they erect it in Boston Commons. It's generally supposed to be 40 or 50 feet tall, 12 to 16 meters for our international listeners.
That's bigger than my Christmas tree.
It's smaller than the Rockefeller Center tree by about half, but Boston is smaller than New York by more than half.
And Canada's smaller than the United States by well more than half.
Yeah, population-wise.
Yeah.
So every year, there are actually people whose job it is throughout the year to wander around Nova Scotia and look at trees in people's yards and or farms and going, ring the doorbell like, hey, have you ever thought about donating your tree to the Halifax, Boston?
These are not cultivated Christmas trees. This is just a nice evergreen on somebody's back acreage.
Yeah. And people and apparently within Nova Scotia culture and Halifax city culture, it's considered a great honor to,
I would think so,
donate your big tree
to give the city of Boston its annual tree,
to give the city of Boston for their help in the Halifax explosion.
I do think it's a bummer that they get cut down. Like, I wish there was
a way for them to
just send it with the root ball,
uproot it and take it down.
I mean, I guess it means you got a new giant evergreen on Boston Common every year. It's it's probably not sustainable.
Yeah, it does feel. What was the one in Rockefeller Center where they had erected it already in Rockefeller Center, and then they realized there was an owl living in it?
Oh, I remember
that. That it made the whole journey and was still just up there, like, ooh.
This is the plot of a Chip and Dale cartoon.
Ooh. I mean, it does feel like a children's book.
Owlie the owl in the big city. So to this day, the Halifax explosion is remembered every Christmas, I guess.
Yes. So our listeners, the futurelings of the present who are living in either Halifax or Boston, and the journey that the train makes on the Blue Nose, that the tree makes, is actually a thing where school children in Halifax line up to watch the tree leave, and school children in Boston line up to see it arrive.
This is all very hands across the sea. This is why there has not been a war between Massachusetts and Nova Scotia.
That's right.
Ever since that time.
It still is possible that there could be a war between Massachusetts and Newfoundland, but only futurelings will know.
They better start sending us trees. And that concludes the Halifax Explosion, entry 562.JB0409. Certificate number 21795 in the omnibus. As you enjoy your holiday merriment in whatever century you find yourselves, feel free to visit at Omnibus Project, where we were social media slaves in our day, just working in the old Twitter mines, slaving away.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Ken Jennings, John was at John Roderick. You can see his Patreon, among other things. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with your downtime over the holidays. If you would like to mail us any kind of festive Boxing Day gifts, you can send those to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. We already got a fruitcake.
What?
Recently. You remember the fruitcake?
Oh, sure.
A Trappist fruitcake. And we just got from Meg... something she, well, it's a facsimile of something she found in her attic. She said her grandpa worked at Pratt & Whitney for 40 years.
Okay.
And when she died and was going through his stuff, she found the Pratt & Whitney Aircraft 50th Anniversary booklet, which she wanted you to have, John, because it combining as it does your interest in military aircraft and fashions of the 1970s. She did not want to give away her grandpa's own copy, but she found a duplicate online.
Oh, cute. I wonder, she might also have a Jefferson Bible in there somewhere.
Yeah, you never know what's up there.
This is cool.
She says, yeah, you don't even need to know what month or year that was from, because you can almost tell by the outfit.
You can tell by the city buses.
And the mustaches on the men. Yeah, thank you, Meg. What a lovely holiday gesture.
So many plaid pants.
you can find your fellow listeners, like Meg and others, by looking up the Futurelings on Facebook or Discord or Reddit. Most importantly, for the health and future of the show, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/omnibusproject during this festive season of the year. If you would like to do a little something for the less fortunate, you should do that. But you should also do something for the more fortunate, John and myself.
Yeah, or the medium fortunate.
To help fund the show. We are grateful for all support, and we certainly reciprocate in terms of the cool new perks, including a monthly bonus show that our Patreon supporters can enjoy. Merry Christmas, John.
Merry Christmas, Ken, and happy winter holiday to all of my fellow agnostic
happy solstice
believers and happy other religion holidays that have winter holidays, which I think is all of them.
Some have probably passed and we didn't say happy Hanukkah and we apologize.
What's up, yo-yo? Happy Kwanzaa. Happy to everyone. Also, to those of you, to all, happy no belief winter time to
I just said
atheist
solstice,
neckbeards.
Because they all believe in science and the movement of the sun.
I bet you right now...
They all believe
now,
in orbits and perihelions and whatnot.
We have some QAnon listeners who do not believe, they probably believe in Christmas, but they don't believe in...
Oh, they're flat earthers.
Heliotropic universe.
Heliocentric. So we need to, what winter holiday do you celebrate if you're a non-believing flat earther?
Happy pizza child abuse.
Happy Grinch
celebration.
Christmas special.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, or if you recognize any of these holidays. You're probably celebrating Ectoplasm Mondays.
We love Ectoplasm Monday. We all get pizza. We get a pizza party.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the honor.